Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Mully and Hall. Mornings live at 5 on Sports Radio 670 The Score. 670thescore.com. Chicago's sports station.
I see the games taking place. I do think we'll probably be about a month late. There could be some teams and some schools within conferences that don't want to play. For instance, if the hard line in California is what it is and UCLA determines they're not going to open their school, well, then they may not compete in the Pac-12. But I noticed Oregon has decided they're opening their doors, Missouri, Purdue. So you're seeing these announcements being made. I believe we'll have a season. Will everyone participate? Maybe not, but I think we will have football in the fall.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. That, the voice of Tim Brando. We talked to him recently, and we are delighted to welcome in Pat Forte. He, of course, with Sports Illustrated, joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Good morning, Pat. How are you?
Good morning, Pat.
Hey, I'm doing all right, guys. How about yourselves?
We're doing okay. We're trying to figure out, you know, I mean, listen, there's a huge difference between the colleges and the professional game, and I think that has really come across as we've talked about some of this stuff. Where, you know, we hear Tim Brando there say that he believes they're going to play and everything's back to normal. Now we got Michigan. You got a president there saying, well, hey, you know, tap the brakes a little. We got to have players. We got to have students back in order to have games, and I don't know that it seems as if everybody's changing their schedule to get people back earlier. I think Notre Dame, did they say August 11th? And other schools have said around the same time frame. We're changing the academic calendar to take advantage of the summer and try to get people out by Thanksgiving. Is that going to affect football? Does that change the football schedule? How does it affect college sports?
Well, it might. You know, we'll see. Football probably less than it might affect basketball. But yeah, there's a number of schools, an increasing number that are going to, you know, whether it's an earlier start or an on-time start in August, and but then compressing the fall semester and getting everybody off campus except the athletes by Thanksgiving break, and then you keep everybody at home for, you know, up to 2 months. You're there all the way through Christmas. Some people will take finals virtually. Some people will get finals done before Thanksgiving. But the short answer to your question is college football is literally and figuratively all over the map. You know, it's 130 schools all over the country. The virus is a different reality in, you know, New Jersey than it is in Nebraska. The Pac-12, you know, there's not any talk there of when they're going to bring people back, to athletes back to campus. In the SEC, it's gung-ho. You know, we're getting them back by June 8th. So even within conferences, because they're so spread out and sprawling now, you know, what's going on at Clemson will be a lot different than probably what's going on at Boston College. So it is instructive. You mentioned the Michigan President Eric Schlissel and what he said, and that was kind of almost a bucket of cold water after the SEC, you know, full speed ahead. Jake Oak, the president at Auburn, might as well stood in the quadrangle with a bullhorn saying, come on, let's get back to campus right now. So it's wildly different.
That's what it was, Pat. I mean, it's like he's the one guy wearing the mask at the party where everybody else is in the pool. And I think he's the one guy whose voice you wonder will be drowned out by all this other enthusiasm. And what value will his words serve in providing caution to a movement that seems to be already, you know, has a lot of momentum? I mean, it's hard to unring that bell now that people want to start to race back to campus. But I wonder what effect his words will have, because, you know, they were a sobering reminder of just how far really these schools do have to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, it is funny that, yeah, I think it's typical of our society as a whole. I think, you know, in some places, some people, and a lot of it is red state, blue state, but not all of it. But a lot of people is like, okay, I'm just done. I'm tired of this. I want my life back. And so we're just going to, you know, go ahead regardless of what the health experts may be saying or the consequences might be. You know, and part of that is I want football, and these people want football on their campuses, and so that's that mentality. And then on the other side, yeah, there's people like the Michigan president are like, wait a minute, we're not even sure we're going to get everybody back when much less play football. That's like 19th on the priority list. So there's definitely, you know, completely divergent points of view here. Now, University of Michigan swings a big stick. As much academically as athletically, but that's a big voice when the president there speaks out. I think people in the Big Ten will listen to that, although at Ohio State, which also swings a big stick, they want people back and playing by June 8th. So I think, honestly, everybody is looking at the states that have reopened and saying, okay, like if the numbers don't all of a sudden get really bad in Georgia, if the Lake of the Ozarks infamous pool party doesn't turn into a just massive virus cluster, hey, maybe we're okay to keep going with this. And universities need money. They need money for tuition payments. They need money for athletics. And so I think they really want this to happen at most places if they can make it happen.
Well, I think, Pat, that's the kind of that's the problem here. When you look at it, you would think that institutions of higher learning would be interested in science. Apparently they're doing calculus and they're thinking more about the $4 billion that could potentially be lost by the Power Five conference football programs, if that math is correct.
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that it's a huge number. And, you know, beyond that, again, like tuition, if you are a parent, either of an incoming freshman or another student that's already been at one of these schools, and you're trying to make a decision, well, do we want to pay $40,000 tuition this year, but it may not be safe, or they may shut things down and send everybody home, or do we just keep them home and maybe we have a gap year, or you go take a few classes at the local community college? That's a lot of money schools are looking at. And then from athletics, if you're listening to the athletic director, I guarantee every AD out there is saying, we got to have football or else we are in ruin. I mean, there was a story, even with football, over the weekend, Connecticut could be looking at slashing the heck out of its number of athletic teams and join the parade there. So it's belt-tightening times to the extreme in sports.
Yeah, that's not good for anybody when you start to see these sports being slashed that are so-called minor sports. But, you know, when you talk to the athletic directors, Pat, when you talk to commissioners around the country, I think we all talk about testing and the need for testing before any of these sports get back on the field and underway. How about the cost of testing? Because is that something that is just going to be absorbed by the individual schools, by the conferences? I mean, how have they talked about initially plans to pay for these tests?
It's a great question, David. And that's again, a non-uniform answer. And again, one of the beauties of college football is also one of its weaknesses, is the fact that it is 130 schools with very different viewpoints, and they are allowed to operate relatively independently. And, you know, I think some schools are saying, I mean, Jack Swarbrick, when I talked to him, we'll be testing the heck out of everybody. Missouri saying, well, if you show symptoms, we're going to test you, but we're not planning on doing it to begin with. I mean, so it is going to be all over the map. And I can't imagine really, you know, sending your kid who's an athlete back to campus in a Missouri sort of situation was like, yeah, maybe we'll test you, but maybe we won't. I just think that has to be first and foremost. But I spoke with another AD who said that the cost of testing was, quote, very sobering. And I'm not sure, you know, when that hits the reality of, okay, we don't have the money for this. We are losing money hand over fist, and now you want us to add a $400,000 line item to the budget. You know, I think people will look for ways to cut corners, which is not a very good way to do business.
How would the change of schedule affect college basketball as opposed to college football?
Yeah, that could be significant, because what you're looking at there, you are basically asking basketball players to stay on campus or travel around playing games for 2 months while the entire rest of the student body has gone home for safety reasons. And I know that has always been the case, that winter sports athletes, two-semester athletes, spend a lot of time on an empty campus alone during Christmas break. But now you're adding weeks to it, and if you're not reducing travel, if you're still, you know, by God, we got to have the Big Ten ACC Challenge, then is that really fair? What are the optics on sending, you know, Northwestern to go play at Wake Forest in the Big Ten ACC Challenge when you're telling all the students, go home and stay home? It's not a good look. So I think there's a possibility, and there's been some discussion, I know, of a conference-only season that starts in January. If school shuts down at Thanksgiving, basketball doesn't start in November, basketball doesn't start in December, it starts in January when school starts back up. But again, not very uniform there. So that could be a conference-by-conference decision as well.
Pat, I know there are a lot of unanswered questions, things that we just don't know yet, but I think moving forward, when you look at how colleges come out of this, whether there's college football this season or not, or they can't have fans in the stands, we've already dealt with the loss of the March Madness. Boy, I know you're the father of swimmers, and you look at the non-revenue sports at college athletics, and you wonder about their futures, and you wonder about their funding, and I wonder if we're going to reach a point where the Power Five schools start to take almost an Ivy League approach to this, where they can't fund scholarships because of financial realities. Is that overreacting to what we are facing? Do you think it could get that bad, or is that extreme?
No, I don't think that's overreacting, because I think there's been basically a tacit decision made at most universities that non-revenue sports just don't matter that much, which I think is a terrible decision, and one that's bad for higher education and bad for the country. And I could get on a soapbox for a while on that, but I think that we have gotten so bottom line about our college athletics that football gets everything it wants and everything it needs. Basketball is pretty much the same. After that, we'll see if we can keep you around, great. If not, well, geez, we have this virus thing, and it gives us an excuse to do what we wanted to do anyway. So I think that there's a mentality out there to that extent, and we're going to see it continue to grow. You know, as the Mid-American Conference has been cutting sports, several schools here in the last few weeks. Again, I said UConn is probably going to make major cuts in June. East Carolina is cut. I think it's going to continue, and I think that that's the expectation is just, well, it's a bottom-line business, which – kind of flies in the face of the NCAA's long-held amateurism standpoint of this is higher education.
Pat, we'll let you go. Just on the way out, got to tap into your horse racing knowledge, because I'm a big fan of the sport. And, boy, I'm trying to think of what the Belmont looks like without that backstretch damaging horses. I mean, it's going to be a mile and an eighth instead of a mile and a half. And that kicks off the Triple Crown this year, and that is going to be bizarre. I don't know how the horses, I mean, they could be different animals by the time they're running in this thing. What does it make it more or less likely to see a Triple Crown winner? Does it just depend on whether there's a super horse?
I knew you would get a horse racing question in a moment. it's going to be a completely different Triple Crown, but I like it. I mean, I first of all, you know, I thought that the Triple Crown as it existed had become had become so out of line with what horses normally do in terms of training and racing schedules. Three times in 5 weeks, they never, ever, ever do that. So now you've got three races spread across 4 months, 5 months. And I think it's going to give, you're going to have a chance to see fuller, more competitive fields. You're going to have more mature horses. You're going to have more rested horses and hopefully more healthy horses. So, yeah, it's weird. The Belmont being a mile and eighth is especially weird. The test of a champion mile and a half thing is out the window. So you start with that, and then you're off for 75 days, and then you have the Derby, and then you have the Preakness a month after the Derby. But I think it's the best they could do with the schedule. You could have maybe tried to run the Belmont in August, but the problem there is, in August, usually they're running at Saratoga then in New York and not at Belmont. So could we see a Triple Crown winner? Yeah, I think there's a chance, and, maybe a better chance because, again, you have the time in between races, but you also should have better competition in each race. So horse racing is one of the rare races that's actually sports that's doing okay because they've kept running in a lot of places and the gamblers have had to throw their money somewhere. And I think this is going to help horse racing be okay. I think it's going to work out.
Excellent. All right, Pat, thanks a ton. Really appreciate your time.
Good stuff, Pat.
All right, my pleasure, guys. Thank you.
Take care.
That's Pat Forte from Sports Illustrated. That's great stuff. That fires me up all sorts of ways. But the college sports thing is a real problem.
Oh,
horse
depressing.
Racing's healthy, David. Horse
yeah.
racing, come on.
It's something.
At least Mully doesn't lose money on the backstretch at the Belmont. I mean,
well, that's all that matters.
Never mind the lives effect.
Exactly.
All right. I apologize.
All these opportunities being ripped away from the young student athletes of America, but at least you're making some dough on the back stretch there.
No, it's not make it. It's not losing. That's okay. Even more important. Right. It's Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 of the Score.
We've had some phone calls with, with Rossi and other players and our pitching coach, Tommy, and that's really everybody's concern. But for me, especially, I just don't want to get ramped up for an unknown date and, kind of have to turn it back down. So it's a fine line of keeping the arm moving, playing some catch, doing some things, not necessarily, maybe getting off the mound right this second. But I think you just, once we get this date, then you can kind of, I've been doing enough stuff to be able to build, and I feel like you're just kind of, mentally waiting for that date, and once that date hits, it's like, okay, now I go.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 of the Score. That is the voice of John Lester. He was on Inside the Clubhouse with Bruce Levine and Matt Spiegel, and it's fascinating to hear him. He just needs a date, and today is a big date in heading to the date because the financial package expected to be discussed starting this afternoon. We are anticipating Major League Baseball making their offer, their money offer to the Players Association, and David, before you can get back to play, you got to figure out what you're going to pay and how you're getting paid, and that's what will be the beginning of being resolved today.
Yeah, I think last week was devoted to kind of seeing how the trial balloons floated and how many, how many people were in favor of some of the ideas being exchanged through the media publicly, with whether it's the revenue split, whether it's prorated, salaries, whether it's how much will the owners hold the players to this clause or provision in the March 26th agreement, which said that they would have a renegotiation if there weren't any fans in the stands. So I think that was last week. What we have heard since Friday, essentially, has been very little, which has been very good. And I think that is encouraging for a compromise that you think is forthcoming. And maybe that's optimism talking, but I think that both sides understand that there's so much to be lost and much to be gained by coming to an agreement, and you don't want to have mutually assured destruction by having a deal fall apart because of financial, reasons. That once you cross the bridge and you say, okay, these are the health and safety issues, We've addressed them. We are as comfortable as we could possibly be heading into this sort of new reality. But now let's talk money. And they can't fall apart because of money. And I think that's where we are today.
Yeah, I think that this is a really important week for baseball because presumably if you want to come back, you pretty much need to be able to nail it down by June 1, and that's a week from yesterday, if I'm not mistaken. And so you need to kind of move this along, and everybody needs to have a spirit of cooperation and trying to get it done. I don't know if we're going to find out in the evening that this was a train wreck. I don't know if we're going to find out that they're heading in the right direction. I just don't know, David. I don't know how serious both sides are about getting this done. And if there is, I think there is a spirit of compromise. And I think it there has to be, quite frankly.
I almost hope that tomorrow when we get on the air at 5 that we have sort of this ambiguity that remains, because I think that would almost be encouraging. No news might be good news in this case, Molly. I think because you're right. I mean, this is as important of a week for Major League Baseball as I can remember because of the necessity of getting some of the logistics handled by the time you want to start spring training, which would be based on the proposals that we have heard or read, the middle of June. So if June starts on Monday, you've got 2 weeks to figure those things out. This is a big week, the biggest in a long time in Major League Baseball.
So we played John Lester coming in, and you heard him talking about just needing a date. We talked to Gordon Whitmire earlier in the program, and he talked about Yu Darvish and the concern that – I don't know that we can say reluctance, but definitely concern that he had over this virus when he was arriving into camp, you know, coming from Japan and having heard all the horror stories coming out of China. He had a totally different perspective on this thing and was actually canceling different events according to different arrangements he had made, losing tens of thousands of dollars, I believe Gordon said, in order to get out of different things because he was concerned about the spread of the virus. And it's almost become, I guess, a self-fulfilling prophecy maybe in his mind, and there is the possibility of reluctance on his part.
Yu Darvish is very much a thinker, and he goes to social media and expresses those thoughts. And in one of those tweets that we've translated, and you can see it on his Twitter feed, he basically echoes some of these concerns and talks about some of the risks, and he talks about how, you know, the risk being involved for the players is so much greater than anybody else, and he compares it to fighting dogs and some of the other things that make you wonder where his head will be if they come to an agreement, Mully. And I wonder if his viewpoints would represent something closer to the exception or the rule, because in John Lester, you heard somebody who, as you described, just give me a date, I'll count backwards, and I'll start to get ready for a season, and I will assume the reasonable risk because I understand that things are in place. I trust my medical staff and all these things. And if you look at the Darvish social media feed, you start to have a different perspective. I wonder which is closer to the majority.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think the other thing you have to wonder is how many baseball players, and I'm not saying that this is the case with you, but how many feel insulated by their wealth that they don't really need to come play in a season?
You're right. You're right. I mean, he's got what, $21 million? Is that what he makes per season according to his contract? He's a wealthy man. And I think that you have different and he's accomplished a lot in his career.
Yeah.
And guys who have, you know, done that and find themselves in that position will be less inclined to take a risk than somebody on the way up who hasn't proved a thing. You don't see – I'd be surprised if you see Adbert Alzolay's social media feed full of things that are raising questions about coming back. Maybe you would. Maybe you wouldn't. I use him as an example because as an unproven pitcher, you're at a different mindset in a different place in your career and probably a different willingness to assume certain risks that a guy like Darvish might not be.
Yeah, I just am I'm fascinated by that idea because what you don't want is to have kind of a hierarchy to baseball where, again, you know, the wealthiest players don't have to play and the, you know, poorest players are, it's incumbent upon them to play. It just, that would be very unpleasant.
Well, it's also something to you wonder, because we talked to Gordon, and understandably so, he mentions players in the story on NBCSportsChicago.com, Sean Doolittle, Mike Trout. He mentioned Anthony Rizzo, John Lester, players who have reasons to be concerned, who have reasons to go cautiously because of the risk involved, but also players who have accomplished a lot and could skip reasonably this season without having anything happen to the arc of their career. Not everybody is in that situation, and I wonder if the people that aren't in those situations, if the kind of the silent majority are the people who are more willing to say, okay, give me a date, I'll report, I understand the risk involved, but I also want to play baseball because this is what I do and I need to make a living.
It's fascinating. I think a lot of this stuff, you really have to stop and think through a little bit. You know, we talked to Pat Forday about some of the college stuff, and he was talking about the idea, you know, could there be a group of kids that want to take a year off, that you get the gap year? You know, the problem with that is the gap year is usually travel around the world year, right? Or go someplace and, you know, do some good work someplace. Well, you know, that's not allowed right now, and that's not encouraged right now. And, you know, you're not going down to the Brazilian rainforest to do any good work because that's not possible at this point.
Most gap years aren't spent in your childhood bedroom. That's typically the case, right?
Right.
Because it's about kids spreading their wings and seeing what's out there and kind of recharging and experiencing life a little bit, not like the life that they've experienced the previous 18 years of their lives, but the moving forward. So that is something to consider as well. But I do wonder some of these realities in terms of, you talked about the opportunities of being deprived, scholarship athletes in certain sports, baseball, soccer, whatever. Boy, they're not going to exist anymore. I mean, are fewer than ever. And I think that is troubling when you, if you care about college sports beyond, you know, the big revenue producers.
You take a year off and get a job. I mean, there are people taking a year off without a job that don't even want to, right? I mean, it's not like there's a ton of possibility on that front either. I just think it's, you know, these decisions that academics are making for the student athlete, they better be based on the student athlete and not on what's best for the university itself. And I get it. I understand that different parts of the country are affected differently, but my goodness gracious, you know, it does seem crazy that you have kind of the gung-ho crowd versus the, you know, cautious crowd. It just, I don't understand that.
Well, it's because you're expressing skepticism that's appropriate, because the gung-ho crowd, a lot of the people who you're hearing from are people who benefit financially in a big way because of the rush to get back. And you understand and you wonder about the motivation, because it isn't necessarily in the best interest of the student athletes. Is it in the best interest of, you know, the bottom line? And I think that is the concern that everyone has.
All right, we're gonna bring in Mike Florio. We're gonna talk to our guy from Pro Football Talk next. It's Mully and Haw on the Score.
Mike Florio, ProFootballTalk.com, NBC Sports, Twitter.com/ProFootballTalk.
He got game. He get better. Bet. He got game.
Insider Mike Florio.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. We love our opportunity to talk to Mike Florio. He joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Good morning, Michael.
What's going on, guys?
We are living the dream. You know, The Last Dance is over, but now we've got Lance Armstrong. So that's almost – oh, no, wait. I can't – never mind.
Spoiler alert, he was using steroids all along.
Don't ask him.
Yeah, look, I haven't watched any of that one yet, but eventually I will.
Mike, what was your biggest takeaway from the match on Sunday in ways that can other sports leagues figure it out? But the way miking participants, was that something that other leagues can learn from?
I think that's awesome. I think it's something golf needs to do more often. It comes off as such a stuffy and stodgy sport. If you want to unleash that game onto a a new generation of fans and get kids engaged. And you got to take them inside. You got to let them see what's happening. And there's personalities there that can be developed, that can be marketed, that can be enhanced. The players should want it, especially the ones that people would like to hear from. The next thing you know, you've got golfers who become podcasters, who become social media celebrities if we are hearing from them and we like what we hear. So I think that there are many reasons for golf to embrace this, and I think other sports should do the same. More access is always better than less access. And look, we'll take anything we can get at this point, so it's not like people are going to demand that their sports come with unfettered access to what the players are saying to each other. But if they really want to enhance it and maximize audiences and maximize interest, this is a way to do it.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I thought that Phil Mickelson was just phenomenal, the way he was talking through some shots, the way he was coaching up Tom Brady. And Sean Payton comes after Tom with a little shot on Twitter. And I know he's joking around, but does Tom?
Well, that's right. And it was funny because I think in a weird sort of way, Sunday humanized Tom Brady in a way that nothing else can, because we saw him duff around the course just like the rest of us do. But he had that moment that draws the rest of us back to the golf course, that one shot that stands out among all of the miscues, even though he split his pants when he was getting his ball out of the cup. The idea that you have that shot that you'll remember, that will be the magnet that gets you to keep golfing and not give it up, because you delude yourself into thinking that one shot, that one magical moment is something that could become your baseline if you really work at it. And that's the other thing too. If I'm a Buccaneers fan, I'm glad he sucks at golf. I don't want him to be good at golf. I don't want him to be doing anything to take away from his focus on being the best quarterback he can be.
Mike, we haven't talked to you since last week. There was a report, John Clayton out in Seattle talked about how Russell Wilson would love to add Antonio Brown to the Seahawks. And he cited sources, said it's not out of the question for the Seahawks to add another wide receiver. Is this even possible?
Well, look, they can sign him. Whether or not the NFL lets him play is a different issue altogether. There were three open investigations that we know about involving Antonio Brown, the first arising from the sexual assault/rape lawsuit that was filed last September that still has yet to lead to any conclusion, discipline, etc. There was the incident of alleged text message harassment after another woman came forward with concerns about Antonio Brown to SI.com. That's unresolved. And then there's the thing that happened earlier this year, the altercation with the driver of a moving truck that Antonio Brown didn't want to pay the fee and allegedly threw a rock at the truck and allegedly basically hijacked the truck and busted it open and took the stuff out that was his. And that's unresolved. So I don't think the NFL is going to let him play anytime soon. I'm troubled by the fact that there aren't specific triggers in the personal conduct policy to force these decisions to a head sooner. That always has bothered me. I think there should be deadlines. There should be a requirement that decisions be made. And if you don't have enough evidence by 60 days, 90 days, whatever, after you begin your investigation, then you got to punt. But they've held this over Antonio Brown for, you know, months now, and I think it continues to hover over his potential continued career. They got a much better shot, I think, bringing back Josh Gordon, who I think will be reinstated by the time training camp opens, than Antonio Brown, who knows when he's going to be good to go.
We always talk about, keeping track of the free agents in the NFL and who's going where, and I understand that, you know, it's difficult to have Cam Newton signed if he can't come in and you can't get a look at him and you can't get the medical and all that, but it's getting a bit late for him not to have signed anywhere. And there's obviously, you know, Jadeveon Clowney wants to get paid, and that's the only thing holding up him being signed somewhere. When are we going to see resolution with some of these guys?
I think the key is you have to have the ability to bring these guys in. You have to be able to check out Cam Newton's surgically repaired foot. He's got a shoulder last year that was surgically repaired that caused him to roll out a new throwing motion. That detail gets lost in the shuffle when we discuss his status. You know, the issue with Cam Newton is very simple. Number one, how much money is he going to want to take? A lot of people are saying, oh my God, how did Joe Flacco get a job before Cam Newton? Well, Joe Flacco is taking $1.5 million in base compensation. Joe Flacco is embracing his role as the backup to Sam Darnold. And here's the other reality, too. Cam Newton is a victim of his own incredible skills in this regard, because if you put Cam Newton on the Jets and you go to training camp and you've got Cam Newton out there throwing the ball next to Sam Darnold, more than half of the roster is immediately going to say, hey, Cam Newton should be the quarterback of this team. And that's the problem as well. You can't bring Cam Newton in to be your backup. And I've seen the reports that he's willing to be a backup. Yeah, because he knows that for most teams, it's going to be obvious from the day he gets there that he should be the starter. And there are teams that are trying to stick with their current process. They have their commitments made to their guy, and they don't want to disrupt it by having someone like Cam Newton who would be clearly better than the guy they have. It's kind of a stupid way to run a football team. But, you know, between the health issues and the reality that if he is healthy, he's going to take over the offense and take over the team, teams have been leery. And I think his best play is to wait for someone to get injured. We know what's going to happen. You know, if you sign with a team as a backup, you are limiting yourself to your one starter getting injured or being ineffective. I think he sits back and waits, and inevitably the phone's going to ring because somebody's going to realize, number one, our starter's hurt. Number two, our backup's not very good. Number three, Cam Newton is Cam Newton.
Mike, the Miami Herald reports that Tua Tagovailoa is a guy who the Dolphins would not rule out playing next year as a rookie. On one hand, it's like, oh, really? That's surprising. On the other, he's the fifth overall pick. Of course, they're going to consider playing him if he's good enough. And Ryan Fitzpatrick is the only thing standing between him and the field. Where do you stand on that one?
Well, look, it all depends upon how healthy he is. And are they willing to give Tua Tagovailoa basically a redshirt year to get himself into a better overall health status and to learn the game from Ryan Fitzpatrick? I mean, the bottom line is Brian Flores is going to put the best guy he's got on the field, period. He did that last year when they had every reason to keep Josh Rosen at quarterback, because the more you lose, the higher you climb in the draft standings and you get to fully evaluate Josh Rosen. Maybe the light finally comes on for him in December and you've got a quarterback that you can build around moving forward. Flores said, screw that. I'm going with the better guy. Fitzpatrick's the better guy. Sorry, Josh Rosen. You're on the bench, even though there's more of a long-term future potential with Josh Rosen. So I think we'll do the same thing here. If Fitzpatrick's the better guy, he's going to play. And if Fitzpatrick's the better guy, then maybe they shouldn't have drafted Tua. Because, you know, just like last year, the ultimate litmus test for Rosen was he couldn't beat out Fitzpatrick. If Tua can't beat out Fitzpatrick, maybe he shouldn't have been the fifth overall pick.
You know, there seems to be a lot of people now talking about how broken the hiring system is in the NFL, and the minority hiring system is what we're talking about here. It was interesting to hear Mike Tomlin come out and say, yeah, you know, go ahead, link it to draft compensation. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, Troy Vincent has admitted it's broken. That's the league office admitting it. And again, the very fact that they're going over different rule changes means they're admitting it. Everybody knows what's going on.
Here's the thing. And this is the guy who practiced law for 19 years. These memories are coming back for me. And I handled cases brought against companies that were accused of illegal hiring practices. And I handled a lot of cases against companies on behalf of individuals whose rights had been violated in the hiring practices. The only thing that forces a company to truly change its way is litigation and or the real threat of it. And until the NFL is truly concerned that someone is going to give up, as a practical matter, his remaining coaching career to be the one who sues one of these teams, because once you sue one team, the other 31 will not touch you. You are done. Once someone is willing to do that, that's when the NFL has a problem, and they're not concerned about it. And they should be. If I was a lawyer evaluating a potential racial discrimination lawsuit against any team out there based upon its minority hiring practices, and I had those quotes from Troy Vincent that he gave voluntarily in an interview without being placed under oath, without being harangued for hours at a deposition where you try to squeeze the truth out of somebody, these cases are so difficult to prove because nobody's going to come in and say, we do a bad job of hiring people based on protected characteristics, and we've got a broken system, and it's horrendous. And, you know, the things that you look at, go back and look at what Troy Vincent said to Peter King. Even without deposition testimony from Troy Vincent, that's enough that you could use to fuel a case. So until that case is filed, or until they apply the foresight to fear the litigation risk and the potential liability, they're not going to fix things. That's the one thing that fixes it, when they realize they either have been sued or they're going to get sued. And the more evidence that is piling up from guys like Troy Vincent and others, it just feels like it's inevitable that somebody is going to be the one to file that lawsuit.
Mike, we're at the point in the pandemic in Chicago where we're tracking down Kevin White. And Kevin White, the first-round bust, tells NBCSportsChicago.com his life as a failed first-round draft pick. Kind of interesting reading. Actually, you know a lot about him. He played his college football at West Virginia, obviously. Do you think he ever plays another NFL down?
No, I think it's done. He had his chance last year in Arizona. It just didn't work. You know, sometimes it just doesn't work. And this is the one thing that drives me crazy about the draft. Every year in the run-up to the draft, the media companies that cover the draft, and look, we cover the draft as well, but we try to be as honest and transparent and candid with the readers as we can when it comes to the fact that half the guys taken in round one are going to stink. They're going to be busts. They've got a ceiling between their college accomplishments and the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and that ceiling is parked over everyone's head somewhere, and you don't know where it is until you put them out there on the field with other professional athletes and you see how they react. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, and it's about 50-50. And during the draft, no one ever says that. It's always, boy, this guy's great. Oh, he can't miss. Oh, this guy's great. He can't miss. Well, half of them will.
Mike, thanks a ton. Great catching up with you. Really appreciate it.
All right, see
thanks,
you guys.
Mike. Take care.
That is Mike Florio. Always fun to talk to him. Yeah, boy, Kevin White, huh? That's a tough one. That is.
Yeah,
just,
14 games in four seasons, Mully. I mean, that when you look at those terms and how much was expected and how much hope there was on draft night. It was in Chicago, and then the injury started, and he just never could get healthy and never could stay on the field.
Really good kid, you know?
Yeah.
Great family. Just didn't work, and
charisma.
The injuries are – that's what went wrong for him. All right. Want to thank everyone. Thanks for calling and texting and emailing.
Most of all, thank you for listening.
Boy, that means a lot to us. Our thanks to our executive producer, Mr. Dustin Rhodes.
He literally threatened to kill.
He's done it. And, of course, Kevbo, bless you, kind sir.
Along with the Z-Pak, which is azithromycin.
Ray, you're the man. Bless you, kind
thanks,
Ray.
Thanks, Ray.
Gosh. Yeah.
Chicago's
going to
love him.
See? David tells you that, and Chicago knows. All right, brother, have a great day for yourself. We'll talk again in the AM.
Have a great day, Mully. See you tomorrow.
It's Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 The Score.
End the story.
I see you soon, baby.
If it is to be said... So it is.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.